Now, from the WMAL WinBet Studios, Vince Cominace.
Good afternoon, 306 WMAL, where Washington comes to talk. Coming up today, Dr. Marty McCarry joins us at the bottom of this hour. He's got a beef with the CDC. They are just messing so many things up. And he'll give us the latest when it comes to COVID and vaccinations and mask mandates and everything else that's happening nationwide. 4 o'clock, Chrissy Clark is here with the Daily Wire. She'll give us an update on critical race theory in the classroom, specifically the way it's manifesting itself in our area. At 4:30, Joe DiGenova makes a Friday afternoon appearance here on WMAL as we chat with him about a lot of legal news, including what's happening in our city streets in Washington, D.C. Shocking images and sounds of gunfire and crime only growing. And then at 5 o'clock, Rich Anderson, chairman of the Republican Party in the Commonwealth of Virginia, with an update on the race there for governor as Joe Biden heads to Virginia tonight to campaign for Terry McAuliffe. We've got a lot going on, starting with the events of last night. Take a listen. CNN's Jim Acosta standing outside last night. These were the sounds he heard on his camera phone.
Like fireworks.
A lot of gunshots going off right there at the intersection of 14th and Riggs Street Northwest. Pedestrians everywhere. Diners go scrambling for safety. This is a well-traveled area of D.C., well-known. Lots of restaurants all over the place. Maria Leaf is standing by in our WMAL newsroom and has, of course, been covering this story extensively. Maria, what's the latest on this? Obviously, this has gotten a tremendous amount of attention given the location that it took place in D.C. We're not accustomed to seeing a tremendous amount of shootings happening there, but it seems like this area, Logan Circle, now we've seen multiple shootings in these past few weeks.
There's been at least two shootings, and I think within a week or two, I believe at this point, a man was shot and killed on 14th Street recently, and then last night, two people were shot. One of them was targeted by the shooter, the other person an innocent bystander from what we understand at this point.
Yeah, and so we see these guys opening fire. I'm looking at the Washington Post reporting. The suggestion here is that it seems multiple guns were at play in this because they say witnesses reported a chaotic scene. There's a guy called Clifford Ortman. He said he was watching as people inside of a black sedan, I guess now identified as a Honda Civic the cops are looking for, drove slowly past the Amazon Fresh tent before at least three guns fired at a group of young adults, he said. Moments later, he said he saw two guns fire back at the vehicle from behind a fence, the gunfire exchange lasting up to a minute before the black car drove away. It is a wild thing to think that, especially this area of D.C., nice area, the kind of place that just 2 years ago you'd feel pretty safe walking to and from restaurants, down towards the White House, you know, a perfectly safe area for a family to walk, becomes a war zone.
Yeah, I mean, it really is unbelievable. And to think you can't even go out to dinner now and enjoy a nice meal outside on a nice night without having to worry about this.
What are local leaders saying about all this? I know Mayor Muriel Bowser stepped up to the microphone now, sadly, yet again, multiple times in just the last week alone. What is she saying?
Well, she did speak. She was there last night after this shooting. She came out. She and the police chief held a very brief news conference. And you know, she says it flat out that she's outraged.
Well, I'm outraged. The chief is outraged. And the community should be outraged.
And Jill, one thing she said that I hadn't heard her say before, because she's been speaking on and off throughout these events that have happened now over the span of the last week. One thing she said last night that was a bit different was trying to get to people before the shooting happens.
We need to get to them before they use their gun. We're asking their family members who know that they have a gun in their home, they're involved in some criminal activity, to reach out before they use that gun.
Yeah, that's not going to happen. That's just not going to happen. People are going to rat out their own family members for having a gun. The whole thing is insane. I mean, so what really needs to happen is that people have to have a sense that there are consequences for their actions, that the Prosecutors have to actually be prosecuting these crimes. We can't just be springing people out of jail the moment we arrest them. You know, last week we talked to Greg Pemberton. Actually, make that early this week. Monday of this week, we spoke with Greg Pemberton, the chairman of the D.C. Police Union. And he was explaining, look, top to bottom, all of the so-called police reforms where they've made it harder for police to actually do their jobs over the past year, all of the cops that they've lost, hundreds of them, hundreds of police officers have now left in a force that was what? I think it was like about 3,400 last year. They're dropping. They're just leaving the force, hundreds of them. That's a big deal. And then the prosecutors aren't taking up the cases. The court system is frozen up. It's not really even going after these things. So the end result is this is a zero consequence zone. It's anarchy. And the guys who are opening fire, they know that.
Yeah, and Chief Conte, Robert Conte, did a walk through the neighborhood this afternoon where he spoke with the community. He spoke with reporters about exactly what you're saying. Especially, he says, the real issue right now is the fact that they can go ahead and arrest people, but the court system's not functioning.
We can take the political route and talk, you know, all of this fluffy stuff. But I'm going to give it to you straight, where the issues are. And where the issues are, the ecosystem, the justice system that we have right now, it is not functioning the way that it should. The courts are not open. That is a fact. Barely open. So cases from last year, from 2020 that happened during COVID, of violent criminals that have not been disposed of, what do you think those individuals are? Anybody want to take a guess? They're in community.
And that's exactly what he's saying. He says he likes to go down to 14th Street as well. His wife likes to go down there. And he's nervous about sending her down to get dinner because of all these folks that are in the community. And the other thing he talked about was the fact that they're down officers right now. And Mayor Bowser recently approved overtime for everybody as much as they needed. But he says that's only part of the issue.
The mayor has supported me in what it is I'm trying to do here. She has said, hey, chief, whatever overtime you need, make sure that you use whatever it is you need. And I appreciate that from the mayor. But here's the thing, that does not solve all problems. The reality is we have a shrinking workforce.
That's right.
I have a definitive amount of resources, 200 and some officers less this year than what I had last year. With
deal.
That being said, what am I going to do with these resources? I can't work these officers to death. I'm not going to have them out here making bad decisions, getting involved in use of force incidents. We need to make sure that we are a police department, a major city police department in the nation's capital, that we are properly staffed to where it is we need to be.
Okay, but there's something else going on here. Look, in several of these high-profile shootings that we've seen these past few weeks, how long did it take cops to get there? No time. They were there already. When Nia Courtney was shot on Friday, 6 years old, it took 34 seconds for a police officer to get there. That's how close the cops were. So it wasn't the absence of cops. Last night on 14th Street, you had cops on patrol right nearby. They were able to get there within, the Washington Post says, within seconds of hearing the gunshots. There were cops on the scene. In fact, that audio that I played at the top of Jim Acosta's video, not only do you hear the gunshots, you see the cop cars arriving within that minute footage of video. So it's not an absence of cops in the case of these shootings, although there are plenty of those. There's something else happening here. I mean, it's not cops present. Great. We need that. But the bad guys don't actually think there are consequences at stake. It's pretty wild.
Well, it's because of the court system and not functioning, is
yeah.
What he basically says, is that you can be charged for something, you're going to be back out on the streets in a matter of weeks because they have not opened these courts.
And I've got another person saying that. Here, listen to this. This is D.C. Council Member Brooke Pinto last night speaking to ABC7's Annalisa Gale. And saying exactly the same thing that we just heard from the police chief today.
I think there is more that can be done.
There's absolutely more that can be done. Those measures, absolutely. But we also have to get our court system up and running. Our courts are not currently operating at full capacity. Many of them are still dealing with COVID restrictions and are not having a full-time hearing schedule. And that's allowing for people who've been arrested to be released back and sometimes are repeat offenders, and that's not acceptable. And so we have to make sure our court system is up and running and working at full capacity so that we can keep all of our neighbors safe. And we need the D.C. Superior Court to hear our calls to do that and make sure that they're in full operation.
Thank you so much.
I mean, how third world is this? I mean, it's like when the power goes out for broad sweeping periods of time, we can't operate. This has gotten this is, of course, completely insane. But the court system is so full and so constricted that we can't even process any of these violent criminals. So they just get back on the street, commit further acts of violence. Is the mayor, I mean, what else can be done about this? Is the mayor even taking this seriously? I realize she talks a lot. She does a lot of press briefings and says she's sad about a lot of this stuff, but where's the initiative?
Well, it's a good question. And I mean, the police chief announced earlier this week that the feds are going to get more involved with this, the ATF and the other offices to try to help with this situation. But again, if you can't get these folks through the court system, you know, and if there's a backlog from COVID, the person who was arrested for last night's shooting, when are they going to wind up in court? If you think about it.
Yeah. Exactly.
I mean, it could be months for them to wind up back in court. And where are they going to be in the meantime?
Right. And we have a system that's like there's no bail. They're out anyway. And they could be back on the street. And they got to show up then for their later hearing after being bailed out. It's just remarkable. And so we're a city in chaos and it's only growing. The homicides only rising. And it's amazing. You know, what's happened in this past week is that the media at large, not here at WMAL, because, of course, we're constantly focused on this, but the media at large has been exposed to two shootings that were basically right in their playground. So one, right outside the third baseline of Nationals Park, you got all these reporters and editors and media people and people with big, you know, high-powered jobs. They're all at Nats Park. They're front and center. They're able to tweet about this, post this on social media. Everybody sees it. Same thing last night. Jim Acosta, it wasn't just some weird coincidence that Jim Acosta was there. It seemed like every reporter in town was there. I saw CNN reporters, just people who were out just apparently having a night. You know, they were out either they were traversing through the area because, you know, so many newsrooms are right down there off of 14th Street, right near the White House. You've got guys who were just out there for dinner. Suddenly this story became like worthy of coverage. Now I'm seeing it all over the place. Oh my goodness, there was this shooting. And it's amazing what it takes to get sort of the national press interested in the story. It's like, oh, it has to happen right next to them for it to be that way.
Well, and Chief Conte said that unless or until it directly impacts you, that's what he wants. He wants the community to get outraged to do something about this because he says what's happening is that it's not happening directly in somebody's neighborhood, so it doesn't really directly impact them.
Yeah.
But now that it's becoming more prevalent, especially in areas where there are a lot of folks gathered, it could be tourists, it could be anybody. I mean, honestly, they're lucky only two people were shot last night. When you think about all the people that were dining out and these guys are just opening fire with reckless abandon, they're lucky that this wasn't a lot worse.
It's horrible. Thank you, Maria Lee, for appreciate all your reporting and that great sound that we got to listen to of what's happening in our city and the reaction from the leaders. I want the reaction from you, though. What do you make of what is happening in our city and how we can confront it and fix it? 888-630-9625, 888-630-9625. WMAL. Remember, Joe DeGeneva joins us at 4:30. He'll have some thoughts on this. I've already gotten an indication ahead of time that he's got a lot to say on this subject.
It's got the attention that it's got now because it's happened where it happened, because we had an incident at the National Stadium. But this issue that's crossing our city, there are too many guns in our city, in Washington, D.C. Last night, before that shooting had happened, the officers, our officers assigned here in the 3rd District, they recovered a firearm off an individual down here at 11th and S, Vermont. Right before that, a firearm right up here, 14th and Irving Street, after the sounds of gunshots, right up there.
D.C. Police Chief Robert Conte reacting today, angry about what took place right there on 14th Street last night. Your reaction to all of this, Donna in Frederick, always nice to talk to you. Donna, good afternoon.
Hi, thanks. It's a pleasure to lead you off on this one. You know, I remember when, I believe it was Dr. Savage who referenced D.C. at the time it was Obama. Well, we're seeing it with Muriel Bowser. The fish rots from the head down. This is someone who supported Black Lives Matter, who named a Black Lives Plaza, and then she's wondering why it's turned violent. Anybody with half a brain can figure out that they're a radical revolutionary group, along with Antifa, I mean, give me a break. I think people in D.C. are sick of it, and the rest of us are all sick of it.
Right.
And it's time to make a big change in the district.
Donna, thank you. Yeah, I mean, she let the city get all smashed up, and everything had to be boarded up last year. She let people, defund the police. They painted the words, defund the police, on that very mural that she put down of Black Lives Matter, and then she left it there. She left it there for months. And it was just amazing. I mean, you know, that was going on. And then somebody writes, you know, the black unborn baby lives matter. They wrote it in chalk. Those people got arrested.
It's sick. And here's the other thing. I think she needs to reinstate everyone who left the police force, give them a raise, because we don't want her to hire a thug group to replace them. She needs to bring those good officers, those good men and women back.
Thank you, Donna. Let's get Scott, who's in our area, the metro area, down in here. Scott, good afternoon.
Hey, how you doing, Vince?
Good, sir. Go ahead.
Hey, well, I'm a somewhat high-ranking law enforcement official in this DMV area, and the shootings that are going on in D.C. are going on in Maryland and Virginia as well. It's the same, pretty much the same group of people. But Chief Conte is right. There's a lot of guns on the streets. The problem is these are not legally purchased guns. These guns were either bought off the street, and they're being used for nefarious reasons. They're not legal guns. And the problem is it's not that the courts aren't working. It's even when they are, they're still not working. Prosecutors are presenting cases and giving judges plea deals with these defendants, and the judges are accepting plea deals with little or no jail time. So there are no real consequences for any of these crimes, any crimes that are going on in this area right
Scott,
now.
Scott, let me play something for you. Here's Robert Conte. This is on a different issue, but close to what you're talking about. He's talking about how D.C. decriminalized pot and basically makes it so pot is pretty readily available. He said that the black market for pot has actually increased crime substantially. Listen.
We have taken on a mindset that marijuana is not really... it's not really a big issue in our city. I can tell you that marijuana undoubtedly is connected to violent crimes that we're seeing in our communities. When you have something where people get high reward, they can make a lot of money by selling illegal marijuana, and the risk is low, the risk for accountability is very low, that creates a very, 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 very bad situation.
In other words, that there's a lot of crime attached to this, and you know, people feel like they got a raw deal or whatever it is that leads to that, that there's some violence going on here, Scott.
Yeah, he's absolutely right. Remember when they used to say that drugs are a victimless crime? That's BS, Vince. The people that are getting shot in the corners, they have families. Aren't their families now victims? This is just, it's ridiculous. Defund the police. They're not defunding the police. They're defunding society.
Scott, thank you for serving as a law enforcement officer in our area. I hope a lot of people I know a lot of them are just like you. Thank you, Scott. Good to talk to you.
Thank you.
All right, a lot more ahead. Like I said, Joe DeGeneva is going to have some reaction to all of this at 4:30. We'll talk about the legal side with him. We'll talk about the courts and what it can take to actually, you know, make the bad guys sense that there are consequences for violence. That's the kind of thing that could help right this ship. Dr. Marty McCary? Oh, he's just moments away. 3:30.
Now, from the WMAL WinBet Studios, Vince Cominace.
Hey, good afternoon to you. 3:35 WMAL, where Washington comes to talk. Yes, we're still tracking the shootings taking place in Washington, D.C. We will come back to that topic, I promise you. I'm hearing from all sorts of people on this subject. A lot of you calling in, getting emails. I've just got an email from a D.C. police officer, actually, said, that's right, nobody's getting locked up in jail. Nobody. Been locking people up in jail. The criminals taunt the officers saying, quote, it's all right, I will be out tomorrow. You can't run a city like that at all. Coming up this morning, make that this afternoon, Chrissy Clark will be with us for 4 o'clock from the Daily Wire. We'll talk critical race theory in the classroom. Joe DeGeneva has a lot to say on the shootings taking place in D.C. He joins us at 4:30. Then 5 o'clock, we speak to Republican chairman of Virginia, Rich Anderson, for the latest in the governor's race in that state. Terry McAuliffe and Joe Biden campaign together tonight. In the meantime, I want to focus on COVID because we're watching as in cities and in school districts across the country, There's pressure to restore some of the lockdown style policies, especially mask mandates. Is that wise? Dr. Marty McCary is a professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and the Bloomberg School of Public Health. He's also the author of the book, The Price We Pay, What Broke American Healthcare and How to Fix It. Dr. McCary, great to have you back, sir.
It's good to be with you, Vince.
Is that prudent that we bring back mask mandates? In particular, I don't think is there evidence that these cloth masks are a particularly effective tool?
So, Vince, as you know, I'm a huge fan of masks and called for universal masking really early in the pandemic. But here's my concern with going to a mask mandate. We're going to politicize masks further. Anyone who wants to wear a mask should.
Right.
Go ahead. Okay. But when you mandate it, you automatically politicize it.
You're reminding me of Governor Greg Abbott in Texas. Remember when he got rid of the mask mandate, and yet Texans, by and large, kept voluntarily wearing them anyway of their own volition?
That's right. And, you know, we're not at the beginning of the pandemic where we're worried about overrunning our hospitals. Right now, anyone who wants to be vaccinated has gotten vaccinated, down to age 12. Okay.
Yeah.
And if you don't, and you don't have natural immunity, you do so at your own individual risk. You're not a risk to public health anymore. And where are these outbreaks occurring? Because there are very real outbreaks right now with the Delta strain in the U.S. Well, they're all localized to rural areas with low vaccination rates. 50% of new cases today, Vince, are in five states, Missouri, Louisiana, and Alabama, parts of Florida, parts of Texas. Let's take a surgical approach. If we have people in Connecticut and Vermont, you know, and D.C. do mask mandates now where population immunity is super high and we don't have a problem, what are we doing? We're reacting with the wrong tool.
Could you contextualize for us the Delta variant for a moment? There's a lot of panicked headlines about the Delta variant. And my fundamental question about it is, yeah, OK, there are a lot of people who are registering as, quote, infected. But that doesn't really tell me the whole story. I want to know more about hospitalization. I want to know more about death. I want to know about severity broadly. What do those pictures look like?
Well, I am very concerned about Delta, but only in the 10 to 20% of American adults who don't have any immunity. That's the group where I'm focusing all my efforts. Otherwise, we don't have good numbers on Delta hospitalizations because we're testing everybody that walks in. Matter of fact, we're doing this blanket testing way too much in people already immune. Matter of fact, the CDC says don't do it. They say don't test people who already have full vaccination. And when you do, when you test everybody with the PCR test, guess what you're going to find in the asymptomatic? A lot of people carrying a tiny portion of the virus load in their system, and they're lighting up and they're inflating the numbers where we are seeing bumps, but those bumps are in the unvaccinated, non-immune. So we're doing too much testing in those already vaccinated with no symptoms.
So what you're talking about, the PCR test, it detects, as I understand it, viral load, like how much of the virus that you're carrying. And if you're carrying even a small amount of virus, does that mean you're, quote, infected? Because, and is there a difference between being infected and actually being sick?
Yeah, big difference. So good point. First of all, the PCR test can detect one dead virus particle in your nose. So that's not a risk to you. It's not a risk to other people or public health. So we really should be talking about viral load, not positive tests. Positive tests scare the crap out of people because back in the days when everyone was susceptible, that was a real early indicator of the epidemic growth curve. Now a positive test in somebody already immune means they might get a little bit of the sniffles. They might get some mild common cold symptoms. That's pretty much as bad as it's going to get for someone with immunity. But yet we're creating this sort of aura that we are seeing a higher numbers beyond what the real numbers are with all of these people with immunity testing positive.
Is there a different age group that is susceptible to the Delta variant than the original COVID-19 that we all know of?
Not really. It's circulating right now in younger people because that's just the group without immunity. So that's why we're seeing more of these cases in younger folks. So you're seeing very high numbers of cases, but not really a proportional increase in hospitalizations or deaths. And if we just look at hospitalizations for COVID illness, which is a subset of hospitalizations for COVID, it's actually lower. Now, there's real bumps going on in the country.
Mm-hmm.
But remember, some parts of the country were super low. So going from super, super low, just down to super low, maybe a 31% increase, as we're hearing, over a couple weeks. But we got to remember, the real areas of concern now are low vaccinated communities, not the general population.
How does natural immunity, I know you've been following this really closely, how does natural immunity as of this moment, what does the research say, stack up against vaccinated immunity when it comes in particular to the Delta variant?
So we don't have data against the Delta variant, but overall, natural immunity is going strong. It's been about 19 months now that we've had COVID, and we're watching people who got infected early, and they're good. They're good to go. Now, anecdotally, I am hearing that the breakthrough cases of people who were vaccinated are happening at a higher rate in those who are vaccinated than those who had natural immunity. So natural immunity may be better. Now, I wouldn't encourage anyone to go out there and try to get the infection for natural immunity.
Sure.
You want to get vaccinated because it's still very good protection.
Sure. Just kind of amazing thing. So now we've got, we talked about mask mandates a moment ago and sort of pushing people to wear those. And usually when we talk about mask mandates, we're talking about adults, but there's also this subset, this issue of schools. We're looking at a number of school districts around the country that are moving to mandate. Chicago Public Schools, for instance, Atlanta Public Schools. Virginia is making it an option, but strongly encouraging that schools mandate that especially unvaccinated children wear masks. What do you make of that? Is there wisdom in making a six-year-old unvaccinated child wear a mask?
I'd love to see the data that masks help that group. There's no data. So let's not fool ourselves in saying this is what the science shows. That's what you're hearing right now. If we had to rank, by the way, the efficacy of masks in kids versus other things kids can be doing in school, like distancing, spacing, using precautions, masks probably rank number 4 or 5 in terms of the lineage of deterrence. But here's the thing. We have put tremendous restrictions in this country on 50 million kids for a year and a half based on one number, and that is 335 deaths of COVID, from COVID in kids under 18. No one's ever verified those cases. The CDC cannot tell you how many of those cases the COVID caused the death versus was incidental in the death. And we know a lot of them, at least a lot of them, they were true COVID deaths, but still, tell us how many of those 335 kids were healthy. We've never had that data broken down by group by the CDC. For an organization with 21,000 employees, which is how many people work at the CDC, how is it they can't tell us the basic breakdown of those 335 deaths and even verify them when we're making all of these decisions based on that one number? That's a disgrace.
Okay, so somewhere over, you said, what was the number again?
335 deaths from COVID in kids under 18.
Under 18. Okay, so let's pretend for a moment that we said, okay, fine, mask up the high school students. What about the kids that are 14 and under? What about eighth grade and down? What do we know about that age group?
Nothing. We know nothing. Now, from the hard data, we know nothing. Now, doctors will tell you kids are very inefficient transmitters. And I've been talking to doctors around the country and basically asking them, if you know of any healthy kid who's died of COVID, please let me know. We think there might have been one case in the upper Midwest U.S. May have been one case. So if healthy kids are not dying from COVID and those 335 deaths are clustered all around kids with comorbidity, that tells you what we should be doing.
Yeah.
It tells you that those are the kids we got to take precautions with and let the other kids live their lives. You know, some kids struggle with masks. They struggle a lot. Some kids do well with them. And some kids struggle. They get bad dermatologic reactions, rosacea, worsening acne.
Right.
They can't see. They're basically blind in class because they fog up their glasses. They can't get a good seal. So not every kid does well with them.
Well, I got to say, you know, in my case, my six-year-old last year, she was in school, thank goodness. But during that, they were making them wear masks. And we always knew what she ate for lunch that day because it came back in her mask. It was whatever she was eating that day, effectively stayed stuck to her face, and then she would put her mask on, and then she'd come home, would take the mask off, and be like, "Oh, you ate pizza today. We can tell because your mask is disgusting." It's a horrible place horrible thing to be doing to these kids. I think making them wear these masks. I want to ask another question. You've been focused on something I think is really important, and it's the stockpile of vaccines that we have in the United States. We have millions. I learned this from you. We have millions of vaccines that are set to expire in the United States because we're at the point of diminishing returns with people who actually want to take them. So the result is that there's just a lot of vaccines sitting there, and they're going to expire, and they will be useless to anyone. You have a suggestion for where those vaccines should go. What is that?
Look, we're vaccine hoarding in a world where new variants mutate overseas and then they jump back in the country. So we should be thinking globally for a couple reasons. And it's a tragedy. You're right. We've actually already thrown away millions of vaccines because the FDA says they've expired and we didn't think ahead or plan ahead. So they just go in the trash. Why not put them on a truck and just drive them over the border, send them to Canada or Mexico if we're not going to use them before they expire? There's no planning. No one's thinking globally about this epidemic and the variants. They're just sort of sitting on these massive stockpiles, talking about third doses and vaccinating every newborn in America. And meanwhile, it's based on this false assumption that risk is equally distributed in the population. It's not. We know it's not. It's heavily skewed towards comorbid conditions. That's where we got to put all our efforts right now.
I don't know if you know this. Are we vaccinating, say, like the millions of people who are crossing our southern border right now? I mean, a lot of people are turning themselves into custody, right? So they come across the border, they turn themselves into custody of the feds, and then the feds are literally paying, using our money, to transport them all across the country. Did they stop at, like, you know, a little, like a spot to just get a quick shot? Like, hey, here's your vaccine.
Not that I'm aware of. Now, we've had millions of people come across the border with no proof of vaccination, many of whom have brought COVID over. Not most, but there are many, because we're hearing about outbreaks in these communities.
Right.
I've definitely heard of that. So, you know, it's interesting. We have to, you know, impose incredible restrictions, shut down businesses, and ruin the livelihoods of all these Americans. Meanwhile, we've got all these people just coming through a porous border, and no one seems to care that all the COVID is being transmitted.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to do a vaccine mandate, if you want to get that out of your system, how about do it to the foreign nationals who are coming across our border? I mean, it seems like maybe a good place to do it. I, you know, it's just amazing to me and so abusive that we would have millions of vaccines sitting in a stockpile, already some expiring, as you've noted, others set to expire. And instead of preventing variants by sending them to desperate people around the planet, we're trying to browbeat political opponents into submitting and taking the vaccine, Dr. McCary.
Well, you know, the whole reason we're in this mess is that somebody had a COVID infection in India, most likely, that mutated and turned into the Delta variant, and that has now taken over the world. That has become the dominant strain worldwide. Now, if we would have thought ahead, we would have realized, hey, it's not, you know, we live in a small world. It's not just about hoarding and getting everybody, you know, three doses in the U.S. It's about getting healthcare workers in India one dose and doing what we call dose-sparing strategies to try to maximize the number of people we can immunize globally. That's the leadership that has not been there. We have had such massive failures in our medical leadership. I mean, just it's so frustrating, Vince, ignoring natural immunity, ignoring the first dose strategy when we were supply constrained and had a scarce vaccine. We should have focused on first doses. We would have saved tens of thousands of more American lives.
Dr.
So many things now.
Dr. McCary, before I let you go, I have one last question. My understanding is the reason we rely on the emergency use authorization for these vaccines and the conditions of that emergency use authorization is that there is no alternative, that there is no treatment, that if you were to come down with COVID, there's really no other successful way to treat it. So therefore, the vaccines are a must, that we have to have this accelerated availability. First of all, is that your understanding? And secondly, do we have successful treatments for people who now come down with COVID this many months later?
nothing that's really earth-shattering beyond the vaccines. So when you talk about a 50-year-old police officer I just learned of, healthy, who's in the ICU now on a respirator, he sent a message to his friends who have been vaccine hesitant, and he said, get the effing vaccine. That was his message. And so it's really the only big gun we have right now. But molnupiravir will come out. It's an oral therapy. It'll come out probably in the fall. And that'll help. That'll be like a Tamiflu. It'll help maybe downgrade some infections. So we're on a good path right now. But for now, anyone without immunity who's at risk, I would say go get the vaccine and try one dose if you're absolutely refusing to get both. Try one.
Okay. Dr. Marty McCarry, it's always so great to talk to you. Thank you for your sobriety on these issues and being willing to talk about things that the CDC isn't. Thank you, sir.
DC is one of the five areas nationwide where DOJ launched gun trafficking strike forces just yesterday, which are going to focus law enforcement resources across jurisdictions to keep guns out of the hands of criminals. DC is also a part of our 16-city community violence intervention collaborative, which is helping cities implement evidence-based strategies, which have been shown to reduce violence by as much as 60%.
Yeah, Jen Psaki. Suddenly, the White House press corps cares about the gun violence happening in the streets of DC because it's happening in all the places they like to hang out. Asking some questions today. Okay, great. You're confronting gun trafficking. Fine. That's going to do nothing. That's going to do nothing if the court system continues to act like it's no big deal that people are being violent and killing each other and shooting in the streets. If our prosecutors are not going to actually prosecute these cases, if there are no consequences to crime, then crime will flourish. And we're seeing that. We're still tracking this story. Of course, this took place last night near the heart of Logan Circle, the intersection of 14th and Riggs Street, as people were out there dining. Got a lot of people out here trying to call in on this subject, so let's get Richard in Bristow in here. Richard, good afternoon. Go ahead.
Afternoon, Vince. Thanks for taking my call. You know, I'm just sick to death of listening to these politicians, the chief of police talking about illegal guns as if they're CBP arresting illegal aliens crossing the border. This is a people problem. Don't take guns out of criminals. Take criminals off the street, then they can't get the gun.
Yeah,
you can have a billion guns in the street. It doesn't matter until there's someone there to pick it up.
Thank you, Richard. Good point. I want to another angle on the gun issue, though. I want to get Bob in College Park in here. Bob, go ahead.
Yeah, and I was going to say is that you don't see people really shooting up police stations, do you? Unless you just have a death by cop, do you?
That's right.
I mean, you don't see people. And certainly on Capitol Hill, I mean, we won't talk about January 6th, but why not? They didn't have guns. I'll bet you I know why, because they knew if they did, they'd probably be killed.
Yeah. Amazing.
Ashley Babbitt. Sorry, I coughed.
That's right. Ashley Babbitt was killed. Thank you, Bob. And to Bob's point, January 6th, think about, you know, when it comes to consequences, how many people are still in prison right now from January 6th? They're in D.C. jail. Each night they have to get together from their jail cells, sing the national anthem. They're feeling the weight of the government hit them, aren't they?
Now, from the WMAL WynnBET Studios, Vince Colonnais.
Good afternoon, 407 WMAL, where Washington comes to talk. 888-630-9625 is the number, 888-630-WMAL. Yes, chatting with you today about what can be done to take care of our city. All these shootings, homicides, a lot of lip service being paid to addressing it by leaders in the city. I want to get your reaction to all of it. So, yes, I'll be taking your calls as the show goes on. I am seeing on my monitors that Dr. Anthony Fauci is doing an interview on Fox with Neil Cavuto. Do you think they actually talk about gain-of-function research? Rand Paul? Gosh, I hope so. I hope that makes an appearance. If it does, I will share it with you. In the meantime, I want to talk about what's going on in our schools. We're often told that there is no critical race theory in the schools. You stupid parents. How dare you confront our hardworking school board members? You're just angry about nothing. You're making it up. There's nothing to it. Well, it turns out there actually is something to it, especially right here in our area, in Fairfax County, Virginia. Let's talk to a reporter who's sussed it out and shared it with the world. It's Chrissy Clark, writer at the Daily Wire. She reports on higher education and college campus issues and also what's going on in school districts around the country. Hello, Chrissy.
Hey, Vince. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Great to have you with us. Tell us about this story out of Fairfax County and how the words critical race theory are definitely a part of the conversation.
Absolutely. So like you mentioned, critical race theory is consistently being implemented in school districts under the guise of different names. So parents likely can't see it. It comes in the different form of social emotional learning, cultural responsive teaching, a ton of different words. And so when you actually see the words critical race theory, it's kind of rare. But that doesn't mean that it's not being implemented in the school districts. And school districts will oftentimes say, no, we're not teaching critical race theory. We're teaching cultural sensitivity training. It's like it's the same thing. Thank you. But Fairfax County actually sent out, it was supposed to be a, quote, teacher-facing item. So that's an item intended just for teachers to see. But it defined critical race theory among a ton of progressive ideologies and explained how to implement these ideologies in the classroom.
So if you're talking about critical race theory with the teachers and suggesting that that ideology needs to be a part of the classroom, I mean, I'm sorry, I'm dense, but I'm not that dense. Critical race theory is clearly a part of the education in Fairfax County.
It absolutely is. And they specifically do say in this PowerPoint, which you can read over at the Daily Wire, in adopting this approach, they are telling people to talk to their children or their students about critical race theory in the topics of school funding, segregation, language policy, discipline policies, curriculum, assessments, accountability policies, et cetera. And if you're wondering, if you're a parent wondering what that means, if you listen to what Barack Obama said when he was president about restorative justice, critical race theory and restorative justice essentially go hand in hand. So Black students will not be, punished because they are Black. They will take now race into account when it comes to disciplining your students, there are some people that think that's great, and there are some people that think that's bad. But at the end of the day, that was played out. Restorative justice and these discipline policies were played out in San Francisco Unified School District. And you're seeing children getting assaulted, bringing knives to school, and not getting punished for it. Restorative justice practices are what led to the Parkland shooting in Florida. These are bad practices that have bad outcomes, and these are intrinsic in critical race theory. So it's not just the curriculum that you're learning, but it's the practices that make up the culture of the school district.
Okay, so this is an important point. So when it comes to discipline for students, and speaking as a guy who was once a kid who was disciplined in school plenty of times, don't get me wrong, the suggestion here is that Black students, because of the way this critical race theory worldview, need to be held to a lower standard because of the color of their skin.
Yes. Correct. So, if there's a 3-strike policy for a white student, there might be a 6-strike policy for a Black student. It's essentially the bigotry of low expectations that Black students are unable to make the correct decisions that a white student would make, which in itself is racist.
Yes.
But, I mean, that's the entire premise of critical race theory.
Right. So thanks to your reporting here, and there's no hiding from the point that critical race theory is definitely a part of the conversation, and these racist ideologies are being injected into the classroom. Did you get any feedback from is Fairfax County standing by this? Are they full speed ahead on all of this stuff?
Yeah, about a year ago, I started reporting on this issue with Loudoun County School Districts, which is nearby Fairfax.
Yes.
Fairfax and Arlington, and they just stopped responding to me at this point. They know who I am. They know the stories that I'll write. And they refuse to respond because they do stand by it. And they know how stupid they sound when they say, yes, we stand by this, especially in the context of writing all of this out. And you know that they stand by this, not just because of their answers or lack thereof, but because that's where their money is going towards. They're redirecting their spending. They're spent $49,600, according to a report from Parents Defending Education, on an anti-bias community engagement policy survey. This is money going straight from taxpayers' pockets, and instead of educating your kids, it's going to New York City-based diversity, equity, and inclusion firms.
Yes.
It's a waste of taxpayer dollars, and it's all funded by the taxpayer and going to critical race theory training.
So it's completely abusive and bigoted. Chrissy Clark, you have another story up on the Daily Wire that bears mentioning, and it involves the Girl Scouts. I can't tell you how many times I've seen Girl Scout stories these last few years, and they always depress me because they always involve some sort of deranged liberal ideology. But you have a headline up, Girl Scouts push anti-racism guide that claims that colorblindness, quote, perpetuates racism. What's that story about?
Yeah, Girl Scouts, I think, Vince, it's kind of tough from a conservative perspective to want to go after the Girl Scouts. We were talking about this in our office, you know, as conservatives, we want to be there for those groups that create culture and community. And the Girl Scouts always did that. And now the way that they're creating culture and community is by telling you that if you don't subscribe to your ideology, you're perpetuating racism. And it's sad because this is a cultural institution that's been so life-changing for so many, yet they subscribe to this woke ideology. And so the playbook here is that they're saying, if you say, I don't see color or we're the same, you might be well-intentioned, but it perpetuates racism because you're being blind to people's identities. And it's just counterintuitive to what being colorblind actually is. It's not being blind to someone's color. It's about not treating somebody different. It's about not instilling restorative justice practices in the essentially racist agenda that says, because you are X, you cannot do Y. Candace Yeah. Owens is so great at explaining this. Just because you're Black does not mean that you can't exceed. Somehow that's been attributed to whiteness, and that's silly. And yet somehow Girl Scouts is going on and pushing this agenda to young women.
Yeah, they've been out of control for a while now. I remember a decade ago, it was 2010, they were distributing a handbook on media literacy, like how to confront bias in news reporting. And they recommended that in order to confront bias, you just have to go to this handy resource called Media Matters for America. The Girl Scouts were directing people to this deranged liberal hack organization as a way to, quote, balance out media bias. You know you're lost when. Chrissy Clark.
Oh, goodness.
Thank you so much. Great to talk to you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Please keep up the great work at the Daily Wire. Pretty cool.
Breaking news, the inside story on Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
Okay, Dr. Anthony Fauci, I was just able to read some of the closed captioning, haven't heard it, but he's been on Fox, he was with Neil Cavuto, and Cavuto is not asking him any tough questions about gain-of-function research. It's all just like, hey, why are people being so mean to you? Like, is it because you spoke out against Trump? Yes, yes, that's one of the reasons. I'm just a scientist. I'm just telling the truth. A lot of that. That's not going to get us answers. All right, well, you know who should interview him over at Fox is Bret Baier. Bret would do a good job. Bret would do a great job to sit down with Fauci. I'd like to see that. I'd like to see somebody subject him to a genuinely, like, fair interview. I'm not even asking for aggressive cross-examination. You know, you don't got to pin him to the ground and be like, tell me the truth. Just ask him anything. Just ask him a normal question. We had Mary Catherine Hamm on yesterday. Remember, Mary Catherine works for CNN, conservative. And she gets in there and she says, former WMAL employee some time ago. I used to listen to her on the mornings here when she was on with Brian Neiman and Brian Wilson and Mary Catherine all together. And Mary Catherine, just got everybody's jaws to drop yesterday by just saying something true on CNN. That is literally all it takes. Just speak the truth out loud. Did you hear it? Here's Mary Catherine yesterday.
What is the purpose of this fixation on attacking Anthony Fauci?
Well, I don't think it's entirely a game. I think it's that Fauci is a very powerful public official who
yes.
deserves and rarely gets tough questioning in almost any realm. He gets, frankly, a lot of fangirling and a lot of just sort of forum for his ideas. And
including from Cavuto just now. Including from Neil Cavuto just now. Now, look. I doubt Neil's going to want me back on a show now that I'm criticizing him about this. But Neil's always been a very nice guy to me through the years. He's the only person who, this is true, the only person on television who would send a letter and sign it. He would sign like a printed letter. He would thank people for being on the segment. Just a total gentleman. Got a very interesting story. He's confronted all sorts of illnesses through the years that have actually made him. He said he used to be like a totally vicious person to his coworkers, and they had this huge change of heart as a result of his personal struggles. I believe he has MS, and he had trouble. He can't even read the teleprompter because of his MS. He had to memorize the guests and his talking points. Pretty impressive guy for that reason. And so super sweet dude. I genuinely like him on a personal level. I don't really know him that well. I've been on his show a bunch, and he would send these nice letters thanking you. Nobody else on TV does that. Nobody. But then, of course, he like got really upset with Donald Trump, and it manifested itself that way these last few years. And that's fine. That he made that decision. Viewers didn't like it either. It was interesting. But here he is on TV today. He's got a great opportunity. Anthony Fauci in front of him doesn't ask him any interesting questions. And so Mary Catherine's right. It's like, how many times does the guy with the most power in the entire country on the issue that has affected so many Americans, that's killed 600,000 and then locked down millions, how many times can that guy sit for an interview and not be subjected to a basic question about, I don't know, how many times he's admitted lying? He's admitted to lying multiple times to condition the public response. Remember? Once he said, well, I kept moving the goalposts on herd immunity based on public polling. He said that to the New York Times. He admitted that he lied about masks, that he lied about the masks, because early on he said, oh, you don't need a mask, it's fine. And then he admitted, actually, the reason we were telling you don't need a mask is because we were trying to hold them in reserve for healthcare workers. Okay, say that. Just be honest with the American people, because what happens is you begin to diminish confidence and trust in you, and so they don't trust you when you say anything else, when it's evident that you've lied to them. And you've now admitted it three times. The third time was, remember, Rand Paul asked him, wait a second, what are you doing wearing a mask? You're vaccinated, brother. You're wearing a mask? That is theater. Oh, no, it's not theater. It's not theater, says Fauci. And then he comes out a couple weeks later, and when the CDC finally changes the guidance and says, okay, everybody, if you're vaccinated, you can take your mask off, Fauci does an interview with George Stephanopoulos. Stephanopoulos asks him about this. What does Fauci say? Yes, the only reason I kept wearing the mask is because I didn't want to have conflicting guidance with the CDC. Okay, so you lied, is what you're saying. So he deceived us. So Mary Catherine says all this on the air yesterday, and John Avalon, all the other people on CNN, they're sitting next to her, and you know how CNN is. They got like 12 people on at once. But in this case, it was four. All of them, mouths agape. They couldn't believe that somebody had said something true. Mary Catherine comes rolling in with, hey, you know that the emperor's got no clothes. It's like, oh, she's right. She's right. I don't know if they thought she was right. They were just grumpy that she said that. They were like, I've got dozens of Anthony Fauci prayer candles at home. I've got to burn my way through. Don't make me feel uncomfortable about lighting that candle. All right, let's get Phil in Fredericksburg in here. Phil, you said I'm being too nice to Fauci. Too nice to Fauci. Go ahead, Phil.
Yeah, you're being way too nice. I think Rand Paul nailed it. I think that Anthony Fauci is the guy. He's the reason that we have the COVID disaster we have now. He's actually directly responsible for 3 million lives lost worldwide, 600,000 Americans' lives lost, trillions of dollars lost. He's the guy that was told, supposedly during the Obama administration, by numerous virologists, hundreds of them said, we don't feel comfortable doing this type of research.
Right.
He took federal money, sent it to Europe, sent it through Europe to China to a lab that we couldn't get accurate information back anyway.
Yeah, no, these are all good points.
Now,
the key, Phil, is if you're trying to make the case specifically against him, there's a couple missing pieces to it, but you're right. You're headed in the right direction. I mean, this is Anthony Fauci funding this lab in Wuhan, China, and trying to make excuses for it, playing word games. No question at all, which is why in like a normal country, we would be concerned about getting to the bottom of this really quickly.
Absolutely. Rand Paul needs to keep pushing. This guy should actually be, Fauci should actually be placed under guard, because I don't want him to wind up like Epstein did in jail somewhere. I don't want, you know, Fauci to fall in the tub and die. We need to know exactly what he knows, when he knew it, who he used, and the money that he used. We need to know the timeline, starting from the Obama administration to now.
Darn
and
straight.
Fauci's the guy.
Yep. Thank you, Phil. Great points all the way along. I'm not trying to be nice to him. I'm just saying we got to get to the bottom of it. And I'm tired of all these interviews where he doesn't have to answer any meaningful questions. I mean, it's not, again, you don't have to crush him in order to ask pointed questions. I mean, you have Rand Paul attempting, you know, and Fauci squirming all the time, but he should be subjected nonstop, but he's not. Instead, he gets Jeff Bezos flying into space type coverage from everybody. Like, wow, you're amazing. How did it feel? What was it like being Dr. Fauci? nonstop. Speaking of nonstop, coming up, our next guest, this guy is fantastic. Joe DiGenova, our buddy, former U.S. attorney to the District of Columbia. He's got some thoughts about our fair district and all the crime that's here and how to stop it. Joe's next, 4:30.
Now, from the WMAL WynnBET Studios, Vince Cominace.
.436 WMAL, where Washington comes to talk. Great to have you with us. As Maria Leaf just told you, we've got Joe Biden heading into Virginia tonight to campaign with Terry McAuliffe. Rich Anderson, chairman of the Virginia Republican Party, will join us at the top of the hour. We'll get the reaction from the opposition. We've got a lot going on in Washington, D.C. Last night, the sound at the corner of 14th and Riggs Street Northwest in a very busy area of the city, a lot of restaurants, a lot of people outside, diners, all of a sudden, gunshots.
Like fireworks.
People running in the streets last night. That audio was actually courtesy of Jim Acosta doing some actual reporting, standing there on the street, raising his camera phone to capture that. And a lot of members of the media were out there. And so as a result, people are paying more attention to this shooting, but we've had a ton of them in Washington, D.C. How do we confront them? Well, let's ask our next guest. Joe DiGenova is a legal analyst and a former U.S. attorney to the District of Columbia. Joe, really nice to talk to you, but man, we've got to figure out how to confront this.
Weakness on display by public officials. This was completely predictable that the city would devolve into this sort of chaotic criminal state. This is another Democratic city which has been governed incompetently, but ideologically. There's an ideology behind all of this. And what's really fascinating about this is that if you're a student of public administration, they have done everything wrong from day one. You destroy your police department, and then you turn to it and wonder why it isn't doing more for you when you need them desperately. You have a chief of police who is caught between the rock and the hard place. He has to please the mayor and the city council. And of course, he's been stripped of his authority to do anything because he can't do anything unless the mayor agrees with it. They've taken away hundreds of his police officers and they want him to do more. Only an incompetent and stupid mayor would expect that. The fact that the chief of police, Robert Conti, and Mayor Muriel Bowser held a news conference last night at the scene of this outrage in the city was an embarrassment that they had to do that. They had nothing to say. They were outraged, as they said. Well, isn't that just wonderful? That's very good for public officials to be outraged. And by the way, ask yourself this question. Where's the U.S. attorney? Can anybody name him? Do you know who he is? Has he had his mush out anywhere talking about this problem? He's the chief prosecutor for the city under federal law. Where is he? And then we get the chief of police telling us that this is all about illegal guns. Well, it is partially. Obviously, these are all illegal guns that are being used in these shootings. But the problem isn't the guns. The problem is the people pulling the triggers on the guns. This is a problem in this city that has been going on for years, and it's not going to be stopped. What you have is a complete destruction of the social contract in the black community. These crimes are never going to stop, and the mayor and the chief of police and the U.S. attorney mean nothing in this process. They don't know how to handle it. They're not going to be able to handle it. And I'll tell you something. We closed our office in downtown Washington, D.C., our law firm. We have moved out of the district for one reason and one reason only. It is no longer a place where you can do business safely or with confidence that you will be treated fairly. This is really a bad scene. Can you imagine the nation's capital, the capital of the free world, and they cannot govern, and they cannot provide safety for the citizens and the visitors. Truly, truly remarkable. 21st century governance by a Democratic mayor. This city has been in the hands of the Democrats for 50 years, and look what they've done to it.
Yeah, they can't protect us, yet they can protect themselves. Leaders in the Capitol, they surrounded, they militarized the Capitol building. They bring in the National Guard. The violence taking place in the city streets here. You talk about the police. Obviously, from the police union to the police chief, they wish they could have more guys on the force. They've lost hundreds over the course of the past year. They're stretched thin, now being put on overtime by the mayor. But that doesn't seem like it's going to do very much, because the rest of the system doesn't support them. The prosecutors don't support them, as you've noted. And they keep talking about how the D.C. Courthouse, the D.C. court system is operating on some sort of limited capacity and has a huge backlog from COVID. So therefore, they don't even have the capacity to handle violent crime like this.
You have a dysfunctional system, and it is a pathetic thing for taxpayers. It's absolutely outrageous that you cannot count on the court system to function. Where is the chief judge? But how can they not handle these cases? This is absolutely outrageous. And this is not about policing. You cannot blame the police for this. This has got nothing to do with policing.
Yeah, Joe, in fact, Joe, you know, Nia Courtney, the six-year-old who was killed on Friday night in Southeast, as well as last night at shooting that took place on 14th Street, there were police officers there within seconds. The cops were on patrol. Right. They were there.
Right.
But that's a sign that, yes, there are police out there, but they're not being supported. There are no consequences for people who open fire on each other.
People need to think about this. This was a shootout on an urban street in an area of Washington, D.C., thought to be safe. People dining at a well-known restaurant and others around it. Multiple shots were fired. There's been various estimates of a few to dozens of shots. From what I'm hearing from people I'm speaking to, there were a huge number of shots fired at this place with impunity, with no fear of retribution, knowing you could get away with it, and obviously with no concern for the shooting of bystanders. This is truly remarkable. And you have an incompetent mayor. I cannot emphasize enough how important it is when in a situation like this that you have a mayor and a chief of police that exude confidence and control. You get none of that from these people. It's really – Muriel Bowser is doing such incredible damage to this city, but she's not going anywhere. This is a Democratic city. The Democrats have put her in office. The people in this city are going to continue to put her in office. There's no price to be paid for weak politicians, and it's so sad to see how this city has just gone down and down and down and down. And you look around the country, and you see good governance in certain places and bad governance elsewhere, and it's pretty easy to tell the difference. And you look at D.C. and it's bad governance. It's government 101 down the drain, and it's public administration being destroyed by incompetent public officials. It's truly remarkable.
And you've got the D.C. City Council, too. So it seems like every time the most delusional possible agenda comes forward from the D.C. City Council, Muriel Bowser is like having trouble juggling the radicals, you know, Charles Allen, the council member, and the pushes to defund the police and to hamstring the police last year. It just seems like it's like everybody who's in charge is trying to handicap the city and make it more dangerous.
Sure. It's like all the other Democratic cities around the country. They've become very left wing, very radical. Some of them are even Marxist. And it is what happens when that happens. Institutions die. Public order suffers immediately. These notions about policing, that they're going to handle situations with social workers, just completely untried concepts. When that situation broke out last night at 14th and R, you want a social worker there? You want a social worker there at that point? You need cops with guns. And they were there. This has got nothing to do with the cops. They came there as fast as they could.
Yeah.
And the illegal guns coming into the District of Columbia, that's never going to stop because it has nothing to do with Virginia or Maryland. Maryland has some of the toughest gun laws in the country. D.C. has an amazing number of tough gun laws, just like Chicago and New York and Los Angeles and these other places. This is about people. The black community has to decide it's going to take control of the people who do this.
Yes.
And set about to fix it.
Right.
And, you know, you can't do that with a mayor like Muriel Bowser.
Okay, Joe, do you have more time for me?
I do.
Okay, good. So what? But Joe, you did a good summary of what you just said. You need to improve the culture. You need to support the cops, and there need to be consequences. Culture, cops, and consequences. That's how we fix all of this. Hold tight. More Joe DeGeneva in just a moment. I want to ask him about some of the things the police chief, Robert Conti, has been saying. Now-
Washington's Mall, 105.9 FM, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
We want to help people. Yes, we should. But you cannot coddle violent criminals. You cannot. You cannot treat violent criminals who are out here making communities unsafe for you, for your loved ones, for me, for my loved ones. They might not want a job. They might not. They might not need services. What they may require is to be off of our streets because they're making it unsafe for us.
D.C. Police Chief Robert Conti reacting with fury to yet another shooting, this time in a very upscale, popular area of Washington, D.C. on 14th Street. On the phone with us is Joe DeGeneva, former U.S. attorney to the District of Columbia. Joe, Robert Conti brings up a point you were just making, which is all of this coddling of criminality is only leading to more of it. And his point, which I'm actually kind of shocked to hear anybody in D.C. government say this, people need to be arrested. There need to be genuine consequences or else this will keep happening.
Well, there's no deterrence in the system right now. This is a free fire zone, literally a free fire zone, and it's done because of public policy. This is not an accident. What you are seeing is a planned reaction. This is public policy by left-wingers. Muriel Bowser, the city council, the Democratic Congress have allowed this to occur. They create policies which are anti-police, whether it's defund the police, get rid of qualified immunity for police officers. When police officers leave, your forces are reduced, you have a reduction in force. The natural and probable consequence of all of this, which is a we don't like the police attitude, is that the criminals figured it out. The criminals have figured it out all over the United States in Democratic cities that they can get away with murder, literally, and they can get away with theft, and they can get away with armed robberies and burglaries. This is amazing. What these Democratic mayors, people like Muriel Bowser, have done, they have made Americans who never thought about it thinking and doing and going out and buying a gun because they know that it's not the police who are the problem. The people who supervise the police are not allowing them to do their job.
Yeah.
And it's disgraceful. And when you have a breakdown of the social order like this, what you get is 14th and R streets last night.
Oh, Joe, you got the causation right on gun purchases. The media keeps inverting that. They're like, oh, look at all these gun purchases. That's what's leading to the crime. No, no, no. It's quite the opposite. The crime leads
to
the
legal
gun purchases.
Those are legal gun purchases.
Yes, exactly. Here's something that I don't think is getting enough attention, so I'd like to give it some. Here's more. This is D.C. Police Chief Robert Conti pointing specifically to pot decriminalization, marijuana decriminalization, and the impact that it has had on crime in Washington, D.C. Rarely talked about, but here's the D.C. police chief.
We have taken on a mindset that marijuana is not really, it's not really a big issue in our city. I can tell you that marijuana undoubtedly is connected to violent crimes that we're seeing in our communities. When you have something where people get high reward, they can make a lot of money by selling illegal marijuana, and the risk is low, the risk for accountability is very low, that creates a very, 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 very bad situation because those individuals get robbed, those individuals get shot at, those individuals get involved in disputes all across our city. I'm seeing it happen more and more all across our city in all different wards.
Joe DeGeneva, talk about the connection between black market drug sales and violence.
Well, what happens when you decriminalize marijuana, and this has been predicted when this concept of decriminalizing marijuana came out, they said, oh, this is going to be great. We're going to take all the drug dealers out of the market. We can do this with marijuana, and once we get that done, we can do it with heroin or whatever. What happens is once you decriminalize, you create another market. It's called the black market because drug dealers know that they can produce a better product, they can get it out faster, they can package it better, and they can charge whatever they want because they know their market. And the same thing has happened wherever drugs have been legalized. And the huge black market then creates pods in a city. There are gangs, which we know exist in this city, and they have their own black market. And if somebody treads on somebody else's market, people get killed. There are shootings. They defend their territory. The chief is right about that. It's just unfortunate that the mayor will not let him be a real cop. And of course, she's decimated the police department by making officers feel unwelcome and degraded by the way they're talked about and treated. The city is getting something it really doesn't deserve, but it's getting something that it asks for, and that's chaos.
Joe DeGeneva, I always appreciate your clarity. I know WMAL's audience does too. Thank you so much. Have a great weekend. I appreciate it, sir.
You bet.
Oh, man, how desperate must Terry McAuliffe be to turn to Joe Biden, of all people, to help him campaign? Like, can anyone give me a hand? I'll do it. Oh, not you, anybody but you. No, Joe Biden, off to Arlington tonight. You know, he's going to campaign for Terry. Can't wait for his mouth to fall down the stairs yet again. That's tonight. What a great line that was. All right. Rich Anderson joins us just moments away, chairman of the Republican Party in Virginia, to react to Joe's big adventure, 459.
Now, from the WMAL WinBet Studios, Vince Colonnais.
Hey, where is Joe Biden going? I know he's going to Arlington tonight. Where is he going specifically? Yeah, yeah, awesome. Okay, good. He's on his way, and that's supposed to start soon. It's crazy. Doesn't the guy have a helicopter? Can't we get him there quickly? I mean, what's the... You got to really make everybody's lives miserable? They got to drive him? That's nuts. Thank you for that. It's going to be interesting. You know, I am really looking forward to this governor's race this year. I realize that it is an uphill battle for Glenn Youngkin and the excellent Republican ticket there in Virginia to succeed, but it's possible. It is possible. And a lot of it's going to come down to Northern Virginia, obviously. But wouldn't it be great if Glenn Youngkin just beats Terry McAuliffe? And especially if it's not even close. Wouldn't that just be incredible? Because it would actually send a message. Now, the media is going to downplay that message, but you know what the message would be, right? The message would be that even Northern Virginia is sick and tired of Joe Biden's crap. They don't want the establishment Democrats in power at all. Terry McAuliffe, his face is establishment Democrat in Webster's Dictionary. Pop it open, there's Terry McAuliffe grinning like a fool. It's true. It's true. And it would spike the Democrats so hard in the aggression of their radical agenda, which has infected so many areas, especially in Northern Virginia, where the parents are all being activated and waking up. I want to talk about woke. Meet a Northern Virginia parent who's got a kid in these schools in places like Loudoun and Fairfax counties. It would just be, oh, a backhanded smack, metaphorically, of course, to the Biden agenda. As they get caught this week, pushing critical race theory, which we keep talking about. The Department of Education had put an entire critical race theory handbook inside of its How to Reopen Your Schools guide. And then when they were called out on it by Fox this week, even had Jen Psaki yesterday in the White House press briefing, oops, our bad. That was a mistake. A mistake? A mistake is your thumb rolls over on the H key and hits a G, and then you have a typo. It's not a mistake to put an entire handbook on how to put critical race theory in your school system as you reopen it. That's intentional. Like, whoops, I tripped and an entire left-wing radical agenda fell into my school reopening guide. My bad. Never meant to do that. So, you know, maybe this would be a nice opportunity for a brushback. Now, we were expecting Rich Anderson, chairman of the Republican Party of Virginia, to talk about this visit tonight. He's playing hooky on me. What is going on? His voicemail's full. What? It's too full for us. Rich. Come on, Rich. But that's all right. We don't have Rich Anderson. That's fine. But I am paying attention here to what's going on as Joe Biden heads to Arlington. Do you see the Washington Post coverage of this is making me laugh. They're pointing out that, you know, Virginia and New Jersey, which hold their gubernatorial elections in off years, are often seen as bellwethers heading into the midterms. Yes, that's critical, right? So remember, if Terry McAuliffe loses this year, you'll see plenty of Democrats, the media, downplay it. Well, we can't really interpret it as a bellwether. Oh, that's a big bellwether. If you get your tail handed to you in Virginia, it'll tell you a lot about what the midterms are going to look like if McAuliffe gets defeated this year. They say operatives in both parties anticipate an easier Democratic victory in New Jersey. Uh-oh. Putting the spotlight squarely on Virginia, which has trended Democratic in recent years and is seen by the party as must win. You know, they're right to be concerned. There's been a bunch of polling lately that showed that this thing is neck and neck. And it's like we're looking, you know, 2-3 points, very, very slim margins favoring McAuliffe. But within the margin of error, oftentimes. So Glenn Youngkin doing some good things, appealing to people, and able to hold sort of all those factions together, right, among Republicans, and must be appealing to some of these independents who are sick and tired of Democrat governance. I mean, they stuck with Ralph Northam in Virginia, blackface Ralph Northam, the guy who tried to moonwalk his way out of a scandal. It got so bad that his wife had to warn him, don't moonwalk across the stage. That's insane. Okay, I guess I won't. The Washington Post says, but injecting Biden into state and local campaigns also carries risks for Democrats. Oh, really? The president has long shown a tendency to veer off script, sometimes to the point of making distracting comments that require cleanup by him and his aides. Yeah, just make sure there are no, you know, teenage girls standing anywhere near the stage tonight in Arlington. Biden's going to say something creepy about them. Oh, why'd you bring her in here? Oh, I like your stickers. Joe Biden, stop. Stop. Man, those hair clips are really amazing. Ugh, creepy Joe. Creepy Joe Biden. So they want to, they're saying, hey, look, he may make some creepy comments and they could throw everything out of bounds here. It's true. He could do that. Biden's popularity, while steady, is not overwhelming, with many Republicans already turning against him. They're talking about Virginia. Virginia. Still, Biden enjoys few things as much as campaigning and has been watching the national landscape closely. I'm sure he has. I'm sure Joe's like really steeped in all the details. I believe that. According to people with knowledge of the situation, he has approached Democratic candidates to say he will campaign for them even before they ask. It's one of my favorite details. Okay, yeah, okay, Mr. President. Sure thing, uh-huh. Yeah, we'll get back to you. We'll let you know. Even before, people aren't even asking for his help, and he's like, I'm here for you. If you need me, I can say something crazy. No, that's okay. You don't worry about it. I'll take care of it. According to people familiar with the conversation. So Joe Biden trying to campaign for people. And obviously, you know, the people around him are very concerned here. Because it will be. Look, the media is not going to be able to hide it. If Terry McAuliffe gets tail whooped this year in Virginia, that is going to send some very clear signals about how upset the American public at large is with the Democrat Party's agenda. That's it. That's the whole ballgame. And that's what, you know, Glenn Youngkin obviously is hoping for that backlash. And he's hoping that, you know, that he appeals to voters here and can win later this year. So we're going to stick with covering this story naturally. We're going to have Glenn Youngkin on soon again. Always good to talk to him, get an update from the campaign trail. But I think Virginia voters in particular in the Commonwealth have an energy, and it's really important that Northern Virginia be where some of that energy is. Because remember when, you know, when Ken Cuccinelli lost, where did he lose? Northern Virginia. That was it. Because going into election night, as they were counting the ballots, he was up over McAuliffe. He was beating him handily throughout Virginia until Northern Virginia came in. Until you start counting Loudoun and Alexandria, Arlington. When you start counting up Northern Virginia, that's where he loses. And he doesn't lose by a huge margin. Now, obviously, a lot has changed in a decade, but we'll see. We'll see, because If the parents who are furious in Northern Virginia can animate votes for, ultimately, for Glenn Youngkin, and certainly not vote, maybe some Democrats who are parents in Northern Virginia, they can't stomach voting for Glenn Youngkin. They couldn't support a Republican, but they're angry at Democrats. Well, they might stay home. And we could be looking at a very interesting election night this year. It's 5:15. All right. His phone finally started working. Rich Anderson is the chairman of the Virginia Republican Party and joins us on the phone now. Hello, Rich.
Hello, Vince. How are you doing today?
I'm doing okay. Little sore with you. I was like, you know, where's that Rich? I thought he was going to be with us at the top of the hour. I know you got a lot going on, though, today. You got Joe Biden in town tonight in Arlington. What are you guys doing to welcome him?
Oh, well, I know that he's going to take the show, take the stage at 6:30 with his buddy Terry and try to rally these troops. You know, Terry seems to be the only one excited about Terry. They got to ship Joe Biden in here in July. That's never happened in modern memory to have a Republican or a Democrat president in town for their gubernatorial candidate. But that's the reality right now. What I know, we got a group that's going to show up and they're going to protest. And, you know, I've been going to the gas pumps, Vince, and the gas prices are off the charts. Gas taxes have been up 137% since Terry McAuliffe and Ralph Northam have had an unfettered run. And I can tell you, I put out an email and I said, here, sign up with Terry's team to go protest. And we've got a group that's going to show up and they're going to let Joe know what they feel about these high gas prices and everything else.
I guess behind the scenes, Democrat strategists must think that Joe Biden is a draw for Terry McAuliffe. I'm dubious on that. I don't know. It's like, will this really help McAuliffe's campaign to have Joe Biden in town?
Well, that remains to be seen, Vince. Now Joe Biden did fairly well in Virginia, so they're going to bring him in here. Both of them together have spent better than half a century in Democrat politics, so they're birds of a feather. And so, but that race in November of 2020 is a snapshot in time. And quite frankly, I think any reasonable person can look at the Biden record since January 20th. It just hasn't been an F. It's an F minus.
You know, what's going on in Northern Virginia? Do you feel the energy? I was just talking about it a moment ago, especially with these school board meetings. I feel like there are Democrats who are probably sick and tired of some of the Democrat governance. They may sit out this year, the election. And then there are people who are very energized to take down some of these Democrats who are making their lives miserable, making the lives of their children miserable. What do you sense, especially in Northern Virginia?
Well, what I'm sensing, the ideological extremism that we see flowing out of Washington, flowing out of Richmond, it is resonating with individuals. I have been with Glenn and Winsome Sears and Jason Meares since they were nominated by convention on May the 8th. I've been around the state with them, alone with them, traveling, and I can tell you right now, they mean to correct these problems. We have been through Northern Virginia, Southside Virginia, Southwest Virginia for days on end, and the energy is off the charts. I call it stratospheric. We show up where frequently previous races, you would see modest-sized crowds. They're huge. It's standing room only. It's people having to flow into the outside and huge welcomes for them. And we see the same thing in Northern Virginia. I am seeing a phenomenon I have not seen in many years since Bob McDonnell ran in 2009. I am seeing soft Democrats and a lot of independents indicate that they are with Glenn Youngkin.
Rich Anderson, what role should debates play in Glenn Youngkin's strategy? I know Terry McAuliffe has made a lot out of the fact that he sent some invites to, or they've been jointly invited in some cases to some debates that Glenn Youngkin has turned down. How important are debates to a campaign, and should Glenn Youngkin participate in a lot of them?
Well, debates are important. The public dialogue is important so that voters can size up both candidates. And I think probably you're speaking specifically about the Virginia Bar Association debate. Terry McAuliffe does not get to define the number of debates or whether Glenn does or does not participate. In the case of that debate, I'm sorry, it is being sponsored by an organization that's going to bring in a leftist, biased, compromised moderator. And I simply don't blame him for making that decision. There are probably going to be at least three other venues, maybe more. That's a decision to be made by the Youngkin campaign, but at least three more opportunities for Virginia voters to size up these two candidates.
Okay. Well, I look forward to seeing that. I really do. I think it'll be a big deal to get those candidates on stage and have them, you know, throw a couple metaphorical slugs in each other's direction size each other up. Rich Anderson, thank you very much. Glad to have you stop by.
All right. Thanks, Vince. Take care.
Thanks to Rich Anderson again for stopping by. We've had a lot of great guests today. Joe DeGenova stopped by not long ago now, around 4:30, he stopped by, and we were chatting about the violence that's taking place in Washington, D.C., this time on 14th Street Northwest last night near Logan Circle. Shots fired, people injured, the media out with its cell phone cameras taking videos. The shots are going down. Horrible. But in the wake of Joe's call, we got Arthur in Leesburg, Virginia, calling in. Wanted to add something to this debate. Hello, Arthur.
Well, thank you for taking my call, Vince. And my comment had to do with the fact that when you make policing unpopular, you get a long-term effect for which has a staggering cost that nobody's yet counted. Because you will have to pay a lot more to get police that you're eventually going to need, and you will lower the standards to get it. And my last job in the Army before I retired was on the Army Discharge Review Board. We evaluated requests for an upgrade of the discharge, and we had a large number of people who wanted to get their general discharge. That's a discharge. Essentially, they were invited out of the Army because of discipline problems. They wanted to upgrade their discharge to an honorable so they could get a job on the police department or the sheriff's department. And I was struck by the fact that the people who had trouble with authority wanted to have the authority, which is a dangerous situation. If you look at what happened in every one of these situations where somebody gets killed, you know, by putting your knee on a neck in violation of the department procedures, it's somebody that's not obeying the law or the regulations. That's not the kind of person you want, but that's the kind of people you'll get just to fill the requirement. And so I just wanted to say to the people in the District of Columbia, you're going to be paying for this down the road.
Yeah, when you decrease the morale of the job, when you make it less attractive, when you make people feel like they're going to be miserable in that gig, you drive good people away, and then who are you left with? I mean, that's a great point, Arthur. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great to have you. And we just, you know, have to obviously do, I think Joe DeGenova summed it up pretty well. You know, there's a lot that's at stake here, cultural stuff. Obviously, we have to confront the culture. The cops, we've got to support them. We've got to be able to, you know, this is a job. These guys work hard. I mean, they don't get treated like this oftentimes, but this is a tough blue-collar job. These guys are, like, really taking care of our community, and they're treated as if they're, like, some sort of distant elite that it doesn't care about the community. Man, the average cop cares a lot more about the community than the average politician. They got to be in it every day. They talk to these people. They see these people. You think they want to be out in gunfights? That's nuts. And yet we have politicians that are trying to pull them not only off the streets, but out of the schools. They don't even want school resource officers. You're telling me you don't want kids to have positive experiences with people whose job it is to enforce the law? What kind of world are they going to enter when that person is completely alien to them and the first time they encounter them is not in a positive way? We got to think it through. It's 5:30.
Now, from the WMAL WinBet Studios, Vince Colonnais.
Hey, it's 5:36 WMAL, where Washington comes to talk. Great to have you with us. Always great to have you with us. You can join us by calling 888-630-9625. 888-630-WMAL. The Washington Post headline, get this. We've been telling you about this crazy Bureau of Land Management nominee that Joe Biden's been trying to advance, who was a part of an eco-terrorist movement to put metal spikes inside of trees in order to prevent loggers from cutting them down. So they would stick these spikes into trees. And if a logger's blade, you know, you'd go through it and start cutting with that chainsaw. If it hits, the chain would break. The loggers would be severely injured in some cases. Severely. And so here's the Washington Post headline on how her vote advanced at a committee this week. Quote, Biden's public lands nominee, once linked to eco-saboteurs, advances with key Senate vote. Eco-saboteurs? Don't you think you're taking a little bit of the English off the ball? If you, like, you're really downplaying the severity of what we're talking about here. Just to give you a sense of how bad tree spiking is and was. This was a technique that was apparently pretty common in the 1980s, much more popular than among these eco-terrorists. Here is how the Washington Post, back in the early 1990s, this was in 1990, how they described such an attack that took place in May of 1987 and involved a guy called George Alexander. He's a third-generation mill worker, they wrote. This is in 1990. And he was just starting his shift at the Louisiana Pacific Lumber Mill in Cloverdale, California, when the log would alter his life, rolled down his conveyor belt toward a high-speed saw that he was working on. It was May of 1987. Alexander was 23. His job was to split logs. He was nearly 3 feet away when the log hit his saw, and the saw exploded. One half of the blade stuck in the log. The other half hit Alexander in the head, tearing through his safety helmet and his face shield, and his face was slashed from eye to chin. His teeth were smashed, and his jaw was cut in half. Alexander had never heard of a sabotage tactic called tree spiking until he became a victim of, quote, eco-terrorism, the Washington Post wrote back in 1990. Someone who objected to tree cutting had embedded a huge steel spike in the log that violently jammed the saw. Now, I posted this to social media, and one of my followers came in and posted another reference to a more detailed version of this story. It was posted by the Industrial Workers of the World, but they had this summary of what actually had happened to George Alexander. And this is how they described it. Now, I should point out, the details here are pretty gruesome, but it's worth emphasizing how gruesome these details are, because this is the kind of nominee that Joe Biden is advancing through the United States Senate right now. Somebody who was associated with these vile attacks. This is what they write. Normally, when a big tree is sawed, they start from the outside and square off the edges first. But the tree that George was sawing on May 8th of 1987 was a 12-inch pecker pole. And because it was so small, he took the first cut down the middle. Halfway through the 20-foot log, the saw hit a 60-penny nail. Quote, that nail must have been recently placed and countersunk, George told me. He had checked the log when he started cutting it and had seen no sign of the metal. And because he hit the nail square on, there was no warning sound. Quote, usually there's a high-pitched metal sound and you have time to get out of the way, explained George. He's referring to when they cut up these trees, sometimes there's bits of metal in them. Perhaps it grew into a fence and things to look out for. But this is a tree spike. He was not used to encountering intentional sabotage like this. Quote, this time I didn't hear nothing but boom. He says. The next thing he knew, George was lying on the floor covered with his own blood. Quote, I knew I was dying. And all I could think about was, he references somebody else in the shop and how much garbage he had been giving to him about the saw. He was having a fight with somebody else in the shop. Quote, I tried to get up, but they pushed me back down. I tried to beckon to this guy. His name was Dick Edwards. To Edwards so he would come close enough for me to get my hands around his throat in a death grip. He said, if I had to die, I wanted to take that guy with me. He said, but a 12-foot section of the huge saw blade had broken off and hit George in the throat and the face, ripping through his face mask and cutting into his jugular vein. His jaw was broken in 5 places and a dozen teeth were knocked out. The blade was wrapped around him, they said, and his coworkers had to blowtorch it off while they tried to keep him from bleeding to death. The saw hit me flat, said George. If it had hit me with the teeth, I'd be dead. I'm only here because my friend Rich Phillips held my veins together in the hour before the ambulance came. Now, okay, all of that, horrific. So why in the world is the United States Senate advancing a woman who was involved in attacks like this? Tracy Stone Manning. You know, some Republicans have been speaking out. This is on Fox yesterday. Harris Faulkner was interviewing Steve Daines, Montana senator, and here's what he had to say.
All right, let's just for a second revisit the practice of tree spiking.
All right, actually, I'll tell you what. I've given you enough tree spiking knowledge today. Here's Daines.
Well, Harris, it's outrageous. I sit on that committee. We just voted no, that we should not advance our nomination. It was a 10-10 tie. You mentioned tree spiking. This is what a tree spike looks like.
He held it up.
This is as you exactly described. They drive these great big spikes into trees, and as you described, when the logger then tries to cut it, the blades explode.
Here's more from Steve Daines explaining Tracy Stone Manning's role.
These are all about folks part of Earth First. They were an eco-terrorist group. Ms. Tracy Stone Manning was right in the middle of that activity. In fact, she mailed a letter, and this is the news that came available to the committee just in the last 42 days. It was never available before. She wrote this letter and mailed it on a rented typewriter, this very threatening letter. It was vile, Harris. It was laced with profanity, basically threatening the folks in Idaho, saying you better not go in that forest because the trees have been spiked. That's eco-terrorism.
Yeah, she was a University of Montana graduate student at the time. This was 1989, and she sends this letter on behalf of the terrorists in order to convey their threats. The group driving metal spikes into trees in Idaho set to be cut down, and they wanted to make it very dangerous for the loggers there.
That's why I don't believe she is fit to serve as President Biden's director of the Bureau of Land Management.
Yeah, Republicans trying to speak out against her. Democrats still plunging ahead, trying to get her through. What a remarkable world we live in. It's 5:44. The White House keeps getting questions about Hunter Biden. Hey, wait a second. This art sale scam, it kind of seems very scammy. He just started painting, and his paintings are fetching $500,000. Can you explain this, please? They got some more questions today, but here's Jen Psaki yesterday, insisting, look, Hunter's, they created this phony system. Nobody will know. Hunter won't know who buys his art. Okay, everyone knows what's happening here, right? Hunter's going to know who buys his art. You know that. I know that. Of course he'll find out who was dopey enough to spend $500,000 on his refrigerator art. He will know that instantly. You and I may not ever find out. So when the White House is like, yeah, we're going to keep it secret. Yes, from the American public. That's the point of all of this. So then it comes out, CBS reports this week, that Hunter is meeting ahead of the auction with potential buyers. He's meeting them all. He's going to go to the two separate shows, one in LA, one in New York. He's going to hang out with them. He's going to meet all these people who are very eager to buy Hunter Biden's art. You know, because of the quality of the art, obviously. Here's Jen Psaki reading from a script, trying to explain how this is all on the up and up.
Also, we now know that Hunter Biden is going to be able to meet with prospective buyers at two art shows where his paintings are going to be on display later this year. How does this square with the goal of keeping him in the dark about the buyers of his art as a means to prevent even the appearance of undue influence?
How is this anything but transparently corrupt?
Well, this showing that was that you're referencing was previously public. He's not going to have any conversations related to the selling of art. That will be left to the gallerist.
I love, by the way, isn't Hunter like in his 50s? We're always treating him like he's like 16 years old, you know? Like Hunter, he'll have a chaperone. And he'll be well taken care of. They have an applesauce prepared for him. That way, if he gets a little hungry or cranky, he'll be covered. There will be nap time prior to the visit with all of the potential buyers. So they've got this whole like plan schemed out. Hunter promises he's not going to ask who's actually going to buy his artwork.
As was outlined in the agreement that we announced just a few weeks ago, we believe this is a reasonable system that has been established that allows for Hunter Biden to work in his profession within appropriate safeguards. So he's not going to discuss anything related to the selling of art. Mm-hmm. And I would reiterate that the gallerist will be the only person who handles transactions.
Hunter's a Boy Scout, too, because everyone knows that he's got a great reputation for honesty and integrity. Like, that guy, he would never lie about this. Like, Hunter, of all people.
Or conversations in that vein, and will reject any offer that is out of the ordinary.
Wouldn't it be more...
They would reject any offer out of the ordinary. Out of the ordinary is the $70,000 starting price that you have for these paintings. Oh, they wouldn't take an absurd amount of money. Wait a second. 70,000 bucks? That's like more than most people's salaries. Really? $500,000 for the art that Hunter just started doing because he watched a YouTube video?
Transparent to just release the names of the buyers so that everyone would know who purchased this art and how much they paid?
Well, we won't know who the buyers are. Hunter Biden won't know who the buyers are.
Oh, come on. Come on. It's not that big of a world. The world of people who would spend $500,000 on Hunter Biden's heart. Like, the only reason you do that is to figure out a way to make sure Hunter knows. Okay, so you buy it, and then the gallery is like, nope, we're not going to tell Hunter. And then you just call Hunter. You're like, yo, Hunty, I bought your artwork. What are you going to do for me?
So I think the origin, I think, of this line of questioning, which is understandable, is about whether this would provide a situation for undue influence. But we won't know who they are. So there's no scenario where they could provide influence.
Didn't they just announce on social media that they bought a painting?
Again, I think we have set up a system which we feel is appropriate.
Wait, that's a great question. Did you hear the end of that? She's like, wait a second. Couldn't they just like say on social media? Couldn't they just announce on social media that they bought the painting? Like, how could you? This is not exactly a fail-safe program you got going on here.
Hunter Biden won't know who the buyers are. So I think the origin, I think, of this line of questioning, which is understandable, is
totally
understandable. About whether this would provide a situation for undue influence. But we won't know who they are. So there's no scenario where they could provide influence.
Didn't they just announce on social media that they bought a painting?
Couldn't they just purchase a sandwich board and stand outside Hunter's house and say, hey, I'm the guy? Couldn't they just go and stand outside Hunter's house and hold up the painting and say, yup, it was me? It's a fail-safe system. Everything's perfectly fine. Stop asking questions. 554. Okay, Mike's calling in from Springfield. Mike, come on in here. Hello. You with us, Mike?
Thanks for taking my call. I know I've switched topic here a little bit, but it's involving kids and math.
Yes, sir. Go for
you
it.
You know, for those who so freely suggest kids 3 to 12 need to be wearing masks going back to school, my question is, where is that risk-benefit analysis? You know, is there a peer-reviewed study? On the benefit side, I suspect, you know, CDC and others can tell us how many kids might get sick and spread COVID, although, as I recall, kids were super spreaders until they weren't. But on the risk side, where's the science that, you know, we're talking, 30 million kids breathing elevated carbon dioxide levels in their masks? Uh-huh. And there's lots of studies I can find on atmosphere control levels for adults, like think submarine force. But adults are fully formed. So what about the kids whose bodies and brains are still developing? You know, what are the safety risks involved with 30 million kids breathing their own CO2? Follow the science. I'm okay with it, but where is it?
Yeah, I know. I know, Mike. I empathize because I always have these questions, right? You want to ask all these questions of the government, and then they don't give you any answers. they just shut up and do it. But you're right. You remember that study, by the way, that we mentioned it on the air, that came out in JAMA Pediatrics, Journal of the American Medical Association, a couple weeks ago. It said that increased carbon dioxide inside of the face masks for the kids was harming them. It was a randomized clinical trial. It was a big deal. Like, all these headlines come out. Wow, maybe the face masks are hurting. That journal retracted the study. The words retracted are written all over the website. So either somebody was upset that was published, or the trial was no good. Either way, turns out they still don't know what they're doing. That's the news. Coming up next, the great one, Mark Levin. Standing by, 6 o'clock.